You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
All of you in this room know that last November, the states of Colorado and Washington legalized marijuana in the teeth of a U.S. federal prohibition, something that no jurisdiction in the modern world has done, outright legalization of not only consumption, but distribution, sale, and so on. And those two states are not likely to be the last. There are bills in the legislatures to legalize in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Maryland, Vermont, Nevada, Oregon, Maine, Pennsylvania, that I know of. Ballot initiatives are possible or likely in 2014, 2016 in states that may include California, Oregon, Maine, Alaska. We are just seeing the beginning of something, but what? States began legalizing, began decriminalizing and allowing the use of medical marijuana back in the 1970s. So there's nothing new about that. But something very different seems to have happened lately, as if this iceberg suddenly surfaced above the water with legalization and a new kind of momentum. What's going on? How durable is it going to prove to be? What are the implications, not just for drug policy, but for American politics more generally in this very new territory we're entering? I'd like to welcome you all here to discuss that and thank you for it. This event is part of a series that Brookings and our partner organization, the Washington Office on Latin America, are conducting. We thank Peter Lewis among our supporters for helping to make this possible today. Of course, we thank WOLA for working with us closely. I especially thank our panelists who, as you're about to hear, have done a pretty remarkable job. Most of you have picked up, I hope all of you have picked up a copy of their paper, which is released today on Brookings's website, on the new politics of marijuana legalization. It is a goldmine of information. Bill Galston and E.J. Dionne are very experienced, very distinguished scholars of public opinion, and of course that helps, but it also helps that they had access to, I think it's safe to say, more data in one place than anyone has ever had on this issue before, including some data that is not publicly available, and they did crosstabs in ways that no one has ever even conceived of. You will get the fruits of their research in just a moment. A word about each of them. You can read bios on your own, so I'll keep this short, but Bill Galston is a senior fellow here at Brookings. He's the holder of the Ezra Zilka Chair in Brookings Governance Studies Program. He's a participant in six presidential campaigns. I'm trying to work out how you get to six. And the
Smith, I think. Was it
Smith or was it Roosevelt? And he's the author of eight books. E.J. Dionne, to his left, also well known to you as a syndicated columnist for the Washington Post, well known to us at Brookings as a senior fellow here and a professor in the foundations of democracy and culture at Georgetown University. A great title, by the way.
I didn't write it, but I love that.
I'd like to have that on my business card.
Wouldn't say.
They will each talk for about 10 minutes each on different aspects of their findings. Our two commenters are just really couldn't be better. Anna Greenberg is a senior vice president of Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research. She has 15 years experience in both polling and public opinion research and the methodologies thereof. She has worked with many elected officials, many advocacy groups. Directly on point for us, she has done extensive polling and research for advocates of drug policy reform, including, among many other things, she led the research supporting Washington's successful Initiative 502, which is the legalization initiative that passed in November. She's also been active on this issue among other states. She's done work in California, Oregon, Alaska, South Dakota, Arizona, the list goes on. She has expertise in women and politics, LGBT rights, religion and politics. She's a great person to talk to about social issues. And I also want to make sure to thank her publicly for access to a goldmine of data which she and her colleagues have developed in the course of their research over the last 2 years. I think our panelists will agree that they benefited greatly from access to that work. Last but hardly least is my favorite rising star in the world of political commentary, a man to watch if there ever was one, a reformed lawyer, but no one is perfect. Sean Trendy is a senior elections analyst for Real Clear Politics. He's someone I've always watched because he does his own thinking, his own research, and looks fresh at the statistics every morning to understand what's really going on. He's the author of the 2012 book, The Lost Majority, Why the Future of Government is Up for Grabs and Who Will Take It. And he is the co-author of the 2014 edition of the Almanac of American Politics, often called the Bible of American Politics, which he will be co-authoring with the distinguished Michael Barone. For those of you who are online and who are following on Twitter or who want to tweet a question, we are taking questions via Twitter today. Our hashtag is MJLegalization, MJLegalization. With that, I'll cede the floor to Bill Galston.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. It's a pleasure to be part of this panel, I must say. Each of us has 10 minutes, and I have 7 points to make in my opening remarks, and so I will be brisk. If I had an academic's 50 minutes for a lecture, I would share with you my analysis of how the change in sentiment about the legalization of marijuana tracks the cultural history of the past 4.5 decades of American history. You have, I think, a rise in the early 1960s through much of the 70s, a decline in support, a dramatic decline in support, starting in the late 70s and running through much of the Reagan years, stabilization, a gradual rise during the Clinton years, stabilization during much of George W. Bush's term, and then a takeoff like a rocket in roughly the past 8 years or so. Pro-legalization sentiment is up 20 points in just over a decade, driven in part, but as E.J. will argue, only in part by rising social liberalism among young adults. According to the Pew Research Center, you have a narrow pro-legalization majority for the first time in history, and that broadly tracks what other surveys are saying. So that's my first point, dramatic upsurge in support for legalization. Point two, this upsurge is broadly based. In recent years, support for legalization has risen in every subgroup we examined. Men and women, blacks, whites, and Hispanics, Republicans and independents as well as Democrats, conservatives and moderates as well as liberals, and among all ages and every level of education. Three, this shift is not driven by moral conviction, unlike many other social issues. Yes, the share of Americans who view marijuana use as immoral has fallen from 50 to 32% in just 7 years. On the other hand, the share who view it as moral has barely budged and now stands at only 12%. So what's this missing half of the population? Well, they don't see it as a moral issue at all. And that, it seems to me, is close to the heart of the matter of these shifts. So if they don't see it as a moral issue at all, what do they see when they look at it as a practical issue? Well, this brings me to my fourth point. Public perceptions of basic facts have changed in ways that prepare the ground for a shift towards pro-legalization sentiments. Let me just list 2 of the major perceptual shifts. First of all, marijuana is no longer considered worse than alcohol along the dimensions that most Americans bring to that judgment. Second, and perhaps even more important, there has been a sharp decline in the percentage of Americans who see marijuana as a gateway drug to things that are harder and even more dangerous. That percentage now stands at only 38 versus 58% who don't see marijuana as a gateway drug. Here's the other aspect of the shift towards the practical optic. As far as we can see, a main pole in the tent of the pro-legalization shift is the difficulty and consequences of enforcement of marijuana prohibition. And this, it is much like the shifting sentiments during the 1920s and early 1930s about prohibition. How am I doing, John?
Great.
72% of Americans now believe that government efforts to enforce marijuana laws cost more than they are worth. This consensus includes a majority of every population subgroup we examined. And here was a striking finding. Even when respondents are told that marijuana use is still prohibited under federal law, 60% of respondents in the Pew survey say that the federal government shouldn't enforce its own law in states that have legalized the use of marijuana. Again, this anti-enforcement sentiment is extremely broad-based. Among the subgroups that we examined, there is no group, a majority of which supports federal enforcement against the states. Point six. In our analysis, this issue is not fully analogous to other social issues that it's tempting to try to compare it to. Unlike abortion, there has been a strong shift towards one side of the debate that is unlikely to be reversed anytime soon. The new entrants into the pool of adults in the American population, for purposes of survey research anyway, is on balance about twice as likely to be in favor of legalization as are those who are exiting the pool of adults through death. But unlike same-sex marriage, many of those who favor legalization are nonetheless uneasy about their position. There is a fair amount of residual ambivalence. There's not a lot of enthusiasm. I suppose on some college campuses you could find a lot of enthusiasm. But in the population as a whole, I think there is ambivalence and a kind of resignation to the fact that the effort to enforce marijuana laws, you know, has been so costly, so it's not worth it anymore. Seventh and finally, there is a key unknown, the extent of which is hard to assess. It is possible, I underscore the word possible, that as millennials age, get married, and have children, their views will shift towards caution, much as their boomer parents' views did in the late 1970s, laying the basis for a more conservative tide. Nonetheless, to conclude, we view it as unlikely that the dramatic shift in public opinion that has occurred particularly in the past 10, 11, 12 years will be fully reversed in the decades to come. Thank you.
Thank you. A marvelous summary. EJ.
Thank you. I just want to begin very quickly by thanking Jonathan. There's no one, as you heard, more enthusiastic about the people who work with him than Jonathan. Bill, with whom I've written a number of papers and have enjoyed every one. Particularly want to thank Corinne Davis and Ross Tilchin, who checked all our numbers. This paper is full of numbers. If there's anything wrong in here, it's sure not their fault, and I'm really grateful. And lastly, Mike Dimmick and Anna Greenberg, Mike Dimmick of Pew, and Anna, who gave us one of her specialty briefings over the phone. I told Anna it was so much fun, I want to run for Congress just to get regular Anna Greenberg phone briefings. And Mike was extraordinarily helpful. And so many other people at Brookings I could thank. The fact that this room looks a lot younger than most Brookings rooms suggests one of two things. Either lots of interns have started arriving in Washington, or our analysis in the paper is correct, and maybe both are true. Because when you look at this trend toward legalization, there are two important facts. One you can see, if you have the paper, on the chart on page 2, where the movement, even in the last few years, since 2010, in favor of legalization, crosses all groups and is marked among older respondents. It's important among middle-aged respondents, and there's even an increase among those who are most hostile to marijuana legalization, who are those over 65. But the other aspect of this, which is makes it so interesting to speculate about what the future on this issue is an interesting clumping by age. It has some things in common with the movement toward support for gay marriage, but also there is a difference. On the one hand, what it has in common is there is a large gap between those under 30 and those over 65. If you look at chart 1 on page 12, you'll see the numbers are almost exactly reversed. 64 by 64 to 34, the 18 to 29-year-olds favor legalization. By 33 to 64, people over 65 oppose legalization. That would suggest, and it's what underscores how the way Bill ended, which is we are very unlikely to return to a time when there is strong, overwhelming opposition to the legalization of marijuana just by virtue of generational change. But the clump in the middle is the opinion is much more closely divided. Among 30 to 64-year-olds, 53 to 55% favor legalization. There's been some important shifting in that group towards support for legalization. But that, you know, that makes it somewhat different from gay marriage, and I will come back to that. Where I'll just say that where opinion is on an almost straight line by age. So support just regularly rises the younger the cohort gets. I was telling you, Anna, it must be fun to poll on this issue because it's not like all other issues we're dealing with. One of the things that struck Bill and me when we were going through the data is that this is not, that does not have quite the partisan or ideological flavoring that so many other issues have. Yes, there is partisanship and ideology here. Not surprisingly, Democrats and liberals are more likely to favor legalization than Republicans or conservatives. And if you put them together in the smaller groups, liberal Democrats are very strongly for legalization. Conservative Republicans are strongly against. But what's striking is that there are very large minorities in each of these groups, liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, who dissent from the dominant view. Thus, do 37% of both conservatives and Republicans favor legalization. Thus, do 39% of Democrats and 25% of liberals oppose it. The relatively small partisan gap in comparison with other issues can partly be explained by the fact that Republicans are nearly as likely as Democrats to say they have used marijuana. 43% of Republicans reported past use, as did 47% of Democrats. Perhaps this gives us some ideas of how we can reach a budget deal on Capitol Hill. Reported use among whites and blacks is identical, but much lower among Hispanic. And there is agreement across partisan lines, and this goes to one of the central points that Bill underscored, that government efforts to enforce marijuana laws cost more than they are worth. You'll see this on one of the charts. This view is held by 72% of all Americans, 78% of Democrats, 71% of, 78% of independents, 71% of Democrats, 67% of Republicans, similar split among liberals, moderates, and conservative. It's also striking that even among opponents of legalization, there is great skepticism about the value of enforcing laws against marijuana and significant support for giving states that legitimize it leeway to carry out their experiments. It turns out that there are a lot of conservatives who not only mouth slogans about states' rights, but actually believe them. Conservatives are among the strongest opponents of legalization, and yet their traditional sympathy for states' rights and also their skepticism about government efficacy weakens their support for strong enforcement. If you, on the direct question, this is all from the Pew survey, if the federal government should or should not enforce federal marijuana laws in states that have decided to allow its use, 57% of Republicans and 52% of conservatives said that the federal government should not enforce its own prohibitions. Bear in mind, these are groups that are opposed to the legalization of marijuana. The gap among Republicans between the proportion supporting legalization and the proportion who nonetheless want the federal government to stand down in the face of legalization's efforts is 20 points. For conservatives, that gap is 15 points. It's also, in a way, nice to know that Democrats and liberals are somewhat consistent on this as well. There's no states' rights gap for Democrats and liberals. The proportion of Democrats who oppose legalization is 39%, and those who favor federal anti-marijuana law enforcement of marijuana laws in the face of state action is 35%, a four-point gap. Liberals are almost identical on the two questions. So that if the argument, I think this could have some very important consequences as the debate over what the federal government should do on this issue goes forward. Democrats and liberals won't want the federal government to enforce these laws because they are actually sympathetic to legalization, but a whole lot of Republicans and conservatives won't want the federal government to enforce these laws because they're sympathetic to states' rights. There is a way in which the issue is a classic social issue. Among religious groups, only two show clear opposition to the legalization of marijuana, again from the Pew numbers. White evangelical Protestants, 59% opposed. Hispanic Catholics, 55% opposed. There weren't enough Hispanic evangelicals in that survey, one suspects. If there were, they too would be opposed. The other groups were closely split. And the religiously unaffiliated, and this overlaps with the young, were overwhelmingly in favor of legalization by a margin of 76% to 20%. A similar and even stronger pattern emerges based on attendance at religious services. Those who attend once a week or more, 63% of them oppose legalization. Those who never attend, only 30% oppose legalization. Again, this is a classic social issue in certain ways. And for white evangelicals in particular, as Bill said, for most of the country, it's not a moral issue. But for white evangelicals, it is. 32% overall say that smoking marijuana is morally wrong, but 55% of white evangelicals believe this. There's some interesting evidence, which we can talk about in the discussion, on the parental gap. It appears from the Pew data there is no gap between parents and non-parents, though a difference between married parents and unmarried parents. But we've seen other survey work that suggests there is a parental gap. I think Anna might elaborate on that for us a little bit. Just so we can move on to the discussion, I want to close this way. The trend, I think, in favor of legalization is unlikely to be reversed radically. But there is a lot to play for on this issue. A great deal depends, because of ambivalence on this, about how these marijuana legalization experiments work. And here, I think what we could see is, for a proponents of legalization, their fear should be prohibition in reverse. Prohibition lost public support because of the unintended consequences. What people who support legalization are going to have to do is make sure that there are not untoward unintended consequences. A lot of times in these referenda, people have supported the legalization for reasons somewhat ancillary to legalization, that enforcement is a waste of public resources, or that it's spotty and unfair. Or that it can be taxed and provide a new source of public revenue.
So whether these trends continue will be depend a lot on the kinds of regulations that are imposed and whether they are successful, and very much on how the federal government decides to deal with the states on this question. And on all this hangs whether strong support for marijuana legalization among young Americans endures, and whether they have the capacity, you, many of you in this room, to create a new majority on behalf of a cause that was once supported by only a few. Thank you.
Thank you. That was marvelous. Let me just put a question to the two of you before we go on to the next two to tease something out here. Incidentally, I urge you all to read the paper. As detailed as that summary was, there's richness and surprises here all the way through it. For instance, with marijuana, unlike gay marriage, with gay marriage, if you know gay people, especially gay couples, you probably support it. Not true with marijuana. With marijuana, it's not who you know, it's what you do. If you smoked or use marijuana, you probably favor legalizing, but knowing people who smoke or use marijuana does not have an effect on legalizing. All kinds of interesting things like that. But here's a question for you two about the future. You obviously don't know the answer, but to get your sense of it, if I'm reading this paper right, what you're saying is, in effect, the consensus has already shifted far enough so there is no going back to a sustainable top-down one-size-fits-all policy of prohibition, that that's unlikely to be supportable in the future. Is that a correct reading?
Do you want to?
I thought you were asking them.
I'll ask these two and then bring the two of you in for your opening comments. I just wanted to follow up with a question. Is the consensus shattered to a point where we can no longer have a national policy of prohibition of marijuana? Well, or does that depend on these outcomes that you're talking about?
I would respond this way.
I think it is much more likely, at least for the next decade or so, that we're going to proceed on a state-by-state basis and that the Congress of the United States will be loath to touch the legal status quo with any length pole you care to designate. And my hunch is that it'll be patchy, that there are some states where the latent pro-legalization majority is close to permanent for demographic reasons and is unlikely to be turned back. There are others where that's not true, and that we may very well be a patchwork nation on this issue for the next generation. So to conclude, the idea of a dramatic change in the legal status of marijuana at the national level, I think, is not a conclusion that flows from these data, at least as I read them.
Patchwork Nation puts it wonderfully. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't think we're quite at a tipping point in a way. I do think we're at a tipping point on gay marriage, that what you're seeing in national surveys are very close splits nationwide. You know, Pew had it a slight majority. There are other surveys that show, slight majorities the other way, but they're all within the margin of error of each other. And I think there'll be a lot of interest on the part of a lot of members of Congress to try to avoid this issue for a while it works its way through.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Anna, your experience with this issue is so granular. How does all this sound to you?
All right. So I decided to go paperless and then didn't charge my iPad. So if it dies, I'll just have to wing it.
We'll help you.
Okay? Thank you for having me on the panel. It's really fun to be part of this discussion, especially after doing so much work over the last couple of years and most of it being proprietary and used by campaigns to actually talk publicly about it is sort of fun. And I'm sort of want to basically expand upon a few of the things that you talked about. In the context of trying to understand why attitudes towards legalization may be different than gay marriage or abortion, for example. There's some parallels with both issues, but it's still different. And the first one is the importance of personal experience. And, you know, in a very kind of transactional way, it's true that if you do a regression model on support for legalization, if whether or not you've ever used marijuana is a predictor of whether or not you support legalization. I would note, by the way, that it really depends on how long it's been. So that if you've used within the last 10 years, you're much more likely to support than if you were a baby boomer who smoked in college and hasn't smoked for 25 years. So it really is that granular in terms of personal experience. But what's interesting about why it matters for attitudinal change is that personal experience is hard to change. You can't change somebody's personal experience. You can't make them have a different experience. So if they have a personal experience that leads them to have a particular attitude about legalization, they're not particularly persuadable. And what I think we're seeing is changes in the country's demographics. We call it generational replacement. You said people dying, I think, or passing away. Generational replacement.
It's much more diplomatic.
It is it? So that if you have somebody, for example, who has a cousin who smoked pot all day and never got out of the couch and never got a job and then started doing, you know, other sorts of drugs, you will never convince that person that it's not addictive, even if it's not physically addictive, and you will never convince them that it's not a gateway drug, even though there's not a ton of evidence that it's a gateway drug. So even though the overall landscape has shifted on those issues, it is very hard to convince anybody who's had that kind of personal experience. On the other hand, if somebody themselves has smoked pot in college and is a productive member of society or knows people who go home and smoke it after work who are professionals and then go to work the next day and are fine, they're much more likely to support legalization because they don't have a personal experience that suggests that it has all these kinds of negative consequences. And in many ways, it's that issue that shapes this more than whether or not you think it's moral. It's really your personal experience. And again, more and more people are having different experiences. You can understand the lack of a parental gap in the same way. In the research we've done, we have not seen much of a gap in parental attitudes about this with people who have kids under the age of 18. And when you talk to parents, it's because they are realistic about what their kids' access to alcohol. And alcohol is illegal for people under the age of 21. And, you know, if kids want it, they have almost unlimited access to alcohol. And they currently have unlimited access to marijuana. So for a lot of parents, they're realistic. They don't necessarily think legalization is going to change that. And, in fact, what they think is that it might actually make things better because trying to have a sort of a regulatory system in place that potentially puts some drug dealers out of business, a small black market. I mean, who knows how this is all going to work, potentially makes it less available or more expensive to people who are under the age of 21. And, you know, some parents say, I'd rather they be high than drive drunk. That's a minority of parents. But if my kids are going to do something, I'd rather be that than alcohol because it's much more dangerous in terms of, you know, drunk driving. So at any rate, the personal experience from the perspective of a political consultant who tries to run campaigns, it's very hard to think about trying to influence people's views about those issues. On the other hand, what we did find in all of our work and was something that we used, I think, or it was part of our strategy in Washington, is there are some people who are movable on the issue. And that's actually what makes it different than abortion and it is very hard to convince someone who thinks, that it's a fetus is a life or, you know, a living baby, whatever the language is, you can't say, no, it's not, right? That's just something, a core values belief that somebody has. And similarly, if you believe a woman has the right to choose what to do with her own body, it's very hard to say, no, actually, she shouldn't be able to have that right. So there's very little you can do to persuade people on abortion. That had been true historically on marriage as well. When I started doing work on marriage equality in 2004, and we spent all kinds of time trying to change people's views in the context of a survey or even in the campaigns we were running, and really weren't able to do it. And what's happened is generational replacement, but also more and more people coming out has changed people's personal experience. And that has as much impact than any of the messaging work that we did. This is where marijuana is actually a little bit different. And it goes to issues you both raised about the kinds of arguments that are used for legalization, which is the system's broken. It's not a good use of law enforcement resources. And it could be a source of potential revenue. And I think that because there is the model of medical marijuana in some states, that is actually, and you can see that states that have medical marijuana, the attitudes around legalization are a little bit different. People are a little more likely to support legalization. And in fact, I would just want to note, Jonathan, that while it's true, knowing somebody who smokes doesn't predict support, knowing someone who uses medical marijuana does. So that you can see somebody actually gets the benefit and that it doesn't destroy their life and, you know, and civilization doesn't collapse. And so, it's a personal experience with someone having the benefits of medical marijuana. So those kinds of arguments, that move people, they tend to move lower information voters, tend to be female, tend to be a little blue collar, Democratic leaning voters. And it moves them. I mean, it's amazing. We did experimental work with media market experiments and tried to see who would move in response to ads. And, of course, we tracked over the course of the campaigns what was happening at the subgroup level. And the movement's substantial. You know, it's 5, 10, 15 points. It's really hard to move people, anything. This country is so polarized ideologically and politically. It's very difficult to move people. But we saw, you know, real movement. And my view is that part of why we move people was, first of all, they sort of, there's a lot of common sense. People actually don't think that it's working, that prohibition isn't working. People are still smoking as much as they want to and whenever they want to and wherever they want to for the most part. So that people generally think it's not stopping it. And they generally think it's true that, you know, probably, you know, law enforcement resources could be used for a violent crime and, or for taking down, you know, gangs that are selling as opposed to dealing with, you know, individual personal use or personal, possession. But the other piece of it, which I think is fascinating, is that they are essentially conservative arguments. And if I would urge you to look at the advertising in Washington State, and what you'll see there is, it's the first ad is a woman holding a cup of coffee and in a coffee shop saying, it's not that I like it, right? It's acknowledging the moral ambiguity or the fact that people don't think it's inherently a good thing the way, say, marriage equality is, or, you know, having the right to choose, or people think there's actually a value associated with it in that sense. And we have, and, you know, she's a middle-aged woman, and says, you know, it's not that I like it, but the system's not working, and then goes on to talk about law enforcement and revenue. And if you watch, and then in the case of Washington, we also had law enforcement as our spokespeople. So we had, you know, former prosecutors and you know, former U.S. attorneys, those sorts of, you know, validators, who also talked about how this was not a good use of law enforcement resources and that the system was broken. And if you watch those ads, you might almost think we were sort of trying to crack down on marijuana as opposed to legalizing it. And what you see is that, for example, while it's true that in the polling you cited, 63% of people over 65 oppose legalization, well, 44% supported it in Washington. It was a lower number in Colorado, over 65. And I think, in essence, because it's inherently a conservative argument that we can control this and regulate this and stop crime and, you know, save money and fund things and make it harder for kids to get it. So there's essentially a conservative argument around legalization that's powerful and persuasive to people. And again, some people have actually seen it happen in real life, and that's why the medical marijuana example is helpful. So when I was doing focus groups in Colorado Springs, where there are medical marijuana dispensaries, there was a woman who was a, you know, middle-aged suburban housewife who said, wow, you know, the lights got turned back on in the park and they're now taking the garbage out of the park because of the revenue from the medical marijuana dispensaries. And she said, I didn't ever think I would support this, but actually, you know, I think this is a good thing to get this revenue. So, I mean, there's all kinds of questions about revenue, but and how much you can realistically raise or and how you tax it. But regardless, that argument was powerful in part because she'd had this personal experience with the medical marijuana revenue. So where we go from here, I agree with both Bill and EJ that the national conversation matters a lot. And while it's true that people generally disregard the federal interference, in fact, we tested that as an argument against legalization, and that was not a powerful argument that the federal government might come in and shut it down. It is the case that if there were kind of a federal effort, and I'm just saying if, because you could easily see this going the wrong way for the federal government, depending on how heavy-handed or how it's handled, but it could have a chilling effect. We don't know. It could. You know, on the other hand, if the federal government sort of basically just ignores it, which seems to be what's happening right now, you know, then potentially the systems get put in place, doesn't make much difference, the sky doesn't fall, there's some revenue, and you know, we see the kinds of changes that you're talking about at the state level, that state by state it'll get passed as other states see how other states, you know, operate as models. I also think how these schemes are implemented makes a big difference, and, you know, how the ballot language is written and the statutes are written matters a lot about cultivation and distribution and how you actually collect revenue. So all of that is sort of an unknown. There are some models from the medical marijuana dispensaries and some real important lessons learned from that, and I know a lot of that's been incorporated, but it's still, you know, we still don't know. I will tell you that when we did the research before Prop 19 in California, that when we did focus groups and surveys in around LA County, where you have a lot of the medical marijuana dispensaries, a lot of the stories about, you know, that sort of going awry, it had very little impact on public opinion about legalization. So, you know, it's not clear how much implementation will matter. It might or it might not in terms of public opinion. Two other things. One, you know, you could go to, this is just in terms of public opinion, you could go too far and alienate your allies. So, for example, there are plenty of people who support legalization who don't actually want a tightly regulated system and taxes imposed on marijuana. Because in some places like California, you basically have de facto legalization under the current system because it's so easy to get a medical marijuana referral, I guess. It's not a prescription. So you have to be careful, you know, from a political sense from the left. And the other piece is we don't really know what's going to happen on the right. One of the things that's really interesting and makes this issue different from both marriage equality and abortion is that there really isn't opposition. There isn't funded opposition. I mean, there's no Mormon church funding NOM. There isn't the massive kind of pro-life complex funding, you know, terrible, you know, ballot initiatives. And there was very little spending. You know, there was some spending in Colorado. There was no spending in Washington against it. It's hard to see where that money comes from, honestly, unless there's somebody who has a personal interest in it. But there isn't a lot of organized opposition to it. And so that also, I think, but we'll have to see. That could change. That could evolve. So I think that the future is very uncertain. And while I agree that I don't see public opinion reversing itself for, in part because of the importance of personal experience and the experiences of the states and what that ends up doing to what, the electorate, which is more and more, in my view, more and more acceptance over time and maybe even seeing the benefit of a regulatory system. I certainly think that the voters in Washington, Colorado saw the benefit of a regulated system over an unregulated system. But that said, there are all these unknowns about implementation, about federal government, about opposition and the left that we don't really know what the impact will be.
Fantastic. Here's your unfair question before we go to Sean. Unfair prediction question. For the next 5-10 years, are we talking about a series of hard-fought battles at the state-by-state level, or are we talking about a shift in opinion which basically just leads to a wave of adoption of legalization almost regardless of what legalization supporters do?
Well, I think it depends on how it's pursued. If it's pursued legislatively, I think it's a hard-fought battle. If it's pursued through ballot initiative in Western states, I'm not suggesting they passed easily, but 55% is not a bad number. Now, granted, it was a presidential year, but we actually looked at, we took the Washington and Colorado electorates and modeled it like it was a 2014 electorate, and they both would have passed. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just about the demographics of a presidential electorate. And we don't have a lot of paid opposition. So I am not suggesting by any stretch that passing these initiatives is easy. It takes a lot of money and professional campaign and research and done right. That being said, you know, without...
You have an interest in
I do. Lots of research. But without paid opposition, it's not as hard fought, I think, as like a legislative fight where you have legislators who are worried about getting reelected and whether or not voting for legalization might affect their ability to get reelected.
Would you care to guess on the next couple legalization initiative states?
No, I would not.
Nice try, though.
There are other people in the audience, like Steve Fox,
Sean
I'm
Trendy,
sure, who can tell us where.
I was especially eager to have you here because you're new to the drug policy and marijuana debate, and because what's happening here isn't just about marijuana, right? It's just part of a larger cultural story about politics. Talk about that for a bit, if you would.
Yeah, well, I did want to start out thanking Brookings for having me, especially Jonathan for inviting me to sit in some really prestigious company. It's probably a Bush League move for me to admit that I'm a little bit in awe, but I'm a little bit in awe. So this kind of ties in, I think, a lot of what people have talked about today, especially Anna talking about the way that the pro-marijuana forces or pro-legalization forces have framed the debate in terms of essentially conservative arguments in some respects. The question is, you know, we hear about this age cohort data, both with regard to marijuana legalization and with marriage equality. And the question is this some sort of shift? Are younger voters more liberal? And in a sense, that's almost tautological. You know, you have these more liberal positions that are being embraced, and you say yes. But in a more specific sense, I think that's a little bit too simple, because there are these other issues that are kind of associated with social liberalism or libertarianism, attitudes on pornography, prostitution, abortion, and a few other issues really haven't moved that much over the past few years. And so what I think we really see has to do with what I think is one of the most important factors in American politics that people don't really like to talk about, but it's class. And it's one of my kind of meta theories of America, which, and someday I'll write a book about this, assuming it hasn't been, but that we define vice in terms of what lower class people do, and that to change that, and what the marriage equality people and the pro-legalization folk have done is to frame these debates in terms of middle American values. In other words, gay marriage is as American as apple pie today. And younger voters who are exposed to the arguments for gay marriage within this frame are accepting it because it is within the American tradition, whereas things like pornography and prostitution and abortion have not been framed as well in that particular way. This is longstanding. You can go back to arguments over prohibition. Alcohol was to keep those immigrants in line, people like Gustav Trendy, my great-great-grandfather, who somehow managed to drink himself to death cirrhosis at the age of 40. I'm not really sure how he did that. Premarital sex had a very strong class aspect to it. You can read David Hackett Fisher's work on the Scots-Irish in Appalachia, and there's nothing new about premarital sex. What's changed is the lack of a strong class angle to it. And so you go back and you ask, why was marijuana, which seems to many of us to be such a harmless drug, especially compared to alcohol, why was it illegal in the first place? And the answer is it was brought to America by Mexican-American farm workers, largely. It was perceived as being used by African-Americans, and it got lumped in. We treated it as a street drug. And you can look at letters. There's a wonderful letter, wonderful and horrific letter from a law enforcement officer in Louisiana to Herbert Hoover in the 1920s saying, look, this stuff is more, I can tell you, this stuff is more dangerous than cocaine or opium, my firsthand experience. These were the reports that were getting back. And this is the way that it was framed to the Silent Generation and the Greatest Generation, you know, films that we now consider campy like Reefer Madness. And there were a whole slew of similar, Marijuana, Weed with Roots from Hell was an actual movie title. This is how it was introduced to people who are today in their 80s. And so it's not really surprising if you go back to 1979, 72% of 30 to 49-year-olds thought that marijuana should not be legal, and 84% of people who are over the age of 50 believed it should not be legal. When you got down to the baby boomers, though, it was a much closer split. And the reason is what we've been talking about, that it, you know, baby boomers encountered it in college. They, you know, some of them continued to use it in their later life. And, you know, if you've been around people who are high on drugs, it becomes immediately obvious the last thing that they're going to do is go out and beat someone up. I mean, I would much rather be around someone high on drugs that I don't know than someone drunk, because it's just a mellow experience, and people saw that.
Marijuana.
What did I say?
High on drugs.
Oh, yeah. Marijuana. It is distinct.
Maybe he has a broader view than everybody on the panel.
But, you know, and if you look at the data, the charts, the wonderful charts in this pamphlet, you'll see that actually the class angle to it has inverted. It is people with low incomes that are more likely to think that it's a gateway drug, that are more likely to think that it shouldn't be legalized. And it's even more striking when you consider that the people in the very lowest bracket probably include a lot of college students who are probably skewing that upward from what adults in low-income brackets believe. It's the same thing we've seen with homosexuality. To someone born in the 1920s and 30s, it was unthinkable. I mean, literally, didn't know even what homosexuality meant, talking to my grandparents. And legal sodomy is flat in Gallup from 1978. Support for legal sodomy is flat in Gallup from 1978 to 1996, around the 43 to 44%. What's going on during that time period? Well, the face of the gay rights movement is ACT UP, throwing down communion wafers in churches. It's gay pride parades. And then you see this tick up start in 1996. And I don't think it's accidental that that's when Ellen DeGeneres comes out of the closet on television. That paves the way for Will and Grace. That paves the way for Modern Family. The Democratic Party's message changes from a more libertarian, you know, we need to let people do what they want to. Hate is not a family value. Which is a brilliant frame, and it puts it strongly in the American tradition of families. We start to see, you know, part of what happens, if you look before Ellen, a lot of the even somewhat favorable people you'd expect in media depicting homosexuality, it is a downscale, almost dirty sexual event. Things like Deliverance, Pulp Fiction. When you start talking about Ellen and Modern Family, it's about as bourgeois a depiction of gay life as you can possibly imagine. And so, you know, you see, even with this different exposure back in 1982, 61% of college grads thought that sodomy should be legal, as opposed to 22% of those with just grade school educations. So that's the largest split among all the cohorts in the Gallup polling. Now, you compare this with some other issues. Adultery and polygamy are still in single digits in most polls. And adultery is bad because it's bad. Polygamy is not something you think of your next door neighbor doing. It's, you know, people in cults in weird places in Utah is the face of the polygamy movement. I've always thought that if three or four Hollywood couples came out as pro-polygamy, you would probably see that number jump up to 30% pretty quickly, because the face of it changes, the way we think of it changes. And as the argument were to become about family and so forth, the thinking of it changes. Pornography, this shocked me, but attitudes towards pornography have not changed over the past 12 years. 30% thought it was moral in 2001, 31% thought it was moral in 2013. The reason it shocked me is the internet. But it's still not something that's really discussed in polite conversation. I think when you get up to an age where people are married, the adultery factor plays in there, but it's just not been mainstreamed yet. Prostitution is still something that you go to the bad part of town to engage in. And abortion is something that just, you know, it hasn't, it's not something you see a lot of celebrities admitting to. It's not something that's celebrated. Most Americans still see it as something of a necessary evil. There is a majority support for abortion, but if you ask about the morality of abortion, those numbers are flipped. So again, to me, this really isn't about a liberal or libertarian cultural shift. It's the way that these things are argued about in society. Even marijuana, you think about the depiction of it in Back to the Future, you know, the 1985 movie. It's the black musicians who are getting out of the car and smoking marijuana. Today, the depiction of the most common pop culture depiction of it is weeds. It's all about the plucky housewife who sells to the suburban jungle. And so, you know, I think if there is an interest in pushing other issues forward, the real lesson is that it has to be framed in terms of law enforcement, in terms of family, in terms of money, things that appeal to the great American middle class.
That's a brilliant observation. E.J. Dionne has a habit of framing unfair headlines out of panel discussions, and I think your unfair headline would be, analyst says pot smoking is a bourgeois family value. Once an issue crosses over to the right side of the tracks, becomes bourgeois middle class, does that mean it's all over for prohibiting that thing?
I think it is mostly all over, unless something comes up to push it back.
I mean, swings them back the other way.
Yeah, you know, even on alcohol, and I'll just be real brief. I mean, we're still a patchwork nation. People forget about it. Yeah. When you get to rural counties in the South, there are a lot of dry counties out there. You know, Oklahoma didn't legalize liquor by the drink until 1986. You had to actually bring your bottle of booze to the bar, and they wrote your name on it, and it went up on the shelf.
You wanted to say a word on this.
Yeah, first, Sean clearly showed he has no need to feel awe. That was a great discussion. And researchers will be mystified as to why people suddenly switched from C-SPAN to rent weed with roots from hell. And then we'll wonder, how did that happen? But here's an interesting thing. I totally agree with you that morality is often defined in class and racial terms. And I don't think there's any doubt that a long time ago, marijuana use was associated with Latinos and African Americans, and therefore disdained by large parts of white middle class America. What's striking now is it's crossed over, and I don't think the data shows that marijuana legalization is quite as much of a class issue now as that analysis would suggest. In our own numbers from Pew, there isn't a whole lot of difference either by income or by education. The two together often a decent, you know, measure of class. There's a bit of a gap, but not an enormous class gap. So that I think the interesting question is when it crosses a certain point, does class disappear? And maybe I can toss that to Anna. And just off Anna's presentation, there are two things that struck us in our paper, which is people who want to legalize marijuana, probably under the tutelage of very smart political consultants, were very smart to begin with efforts to legalize medical marijuana, because there is an enormous difference in attitudes toward medical marijuana versus marijuana for recreational use. One way to put it is medical marijuana referenda are gateways to legalization referenda, and that does appear to be the case. But again, it goes back to, do these experiments work? There was a referendum in L.A. Last week in connection with the mayoral election, which, as I understand it, put some lids, some limits on medical marijuana dispensaries. So it's a, you know, these, again, how the experiments of various kinds work, I think, is going to make an enormous difference. I'm just curious, Anna, on the class question.
Well, I actually think you were making a different point, which is not that there aren't that there are class differences right now, but that once an issue has moved over the Rubicon to being kind of a mainstream middle class, that that it disappears, then it becomes non-controversial.
Right. I agree with, and I think that's right.
Yeah.
But in terms of the numbers now, I don't see a great class split on this issue.
Right. It's not that it's turned upside down, and it's the split has gone away. Bill?
Yeah.
I actually have many more questions than answers in this field, and so I have a question for Anna about data and a question for Sean about data, both of which I think will be in your wheelhouses. I would first note that when you go back to Prohibition, there was a medical exception written into the Volstead Act, and that was a very important safety valve.
And a religious exception.
And a religious exception, right? And
a lot of illegal sale of sacramental wine around the country.
Amen. Okay, now, here's my question for Anna is this. On many social issues, women are more tolerant or permissive or liberal. Mm-hmm. But on this one, the reverse is the case. Mm-hmm. And I'd be interested in your interpretation of that, given the work that you've done on women's views. And for Sean, Carlin Bowman of AEI just emailed me this morning the UCLA matriculating freshman data going all the way back to the late 1960s. And, from these 45 years of trend data, here are three dramatic points.
The question here is, should marijuana be legalized?
Should marijuana be legalized? Okay. 1968, 20% of matriculating freshmen said yes. 10 years, a decade later, 1977, 51% said yes. About a decade after that, it was back down to 17%.
What year? That's 80s, the late
80s? 89 was the nadir. Mm-hmm. And then?
Yeah. And now it is?
Now it is. Well, they last did it a few years ago. It was back up to 49%, and I'm sure it's significantly higher than that now. Given your broad cultural views, how is one to interpret these dramatic swings among people of similar ages and similar backgrounds? These are matriculating college freshmen, no class differences at all, presumably. What's going on in your hunch?
Do you want to go first?
Sure.
Yeah.
Because then I'll forget the question by the time you finish. First of all, and I don't know that I have a gender explanation for this, but men are more likely to smoke marijuana than women are.
True.
So once you control for smoking or using, the gender differences, all but disappear.
But doesn't that just push it back a step?
Well, that's what I said, but I don't have any hypotheses about why men are more likely. But men are more likely in general to do drugs, alcohol, everything than women are. More likely to be alcohol and be alcoholics and addicts, right? I mean, I'm sure that somebody from a psychology department or biology department could tell me why. But just in terms of the political consequence of it, it's also the case that especially in these initiative fights, that women tend to be lower information voters and they tend to gather information late, and so the most movable voters are low information voters. And so when you talk to women about the system being broken, you talk about revenue, especially if that revenue is tagged to healthcare, education, those kinds of issues, you tend to see more movement among women and they start looking more like men. But, as a starting point, less supportive, but actually information has an impact.
Just to underscore Anna's point in the survey, the Pew survey, we cited 54% of men, but only 42% of women said they had ever tried marijuana. That's a big deal on all the other numbers.
Yeah.
Interesting. Sean, what do you think accounts for this yo-yo among college freshmen?
Yeah, so in 1986, on a relatively cold for San Antonio, Texas, where we lived at the time, December night. I'm sitting in a football stadium that's filled with all the students, all the middle school students from the Northeast Independent School District. And Nancy Reagan is on a football field with a podium, and all of us are shouting at the top of our lungs, just say no, just say no. It was effective. And it was part of a general argument that was meant to counter the countercultural depiction of marijuana. And we were taught all the same things that marijuana weed with roots in, from hell taught, which is that, you know, this is a gateway drug. This is a drug that is addictive. This is a, you know, all these things. And I think that made an impact on high school students going to college, their views of the drug. Now, these people today, from the data you're showing, are supportive of marijuana. And again, that kind of goes to the experience. When you get to college, you see your friends smoking up. They're just sitting there kind of glazed over. They're not, you know, blowing stuff up. Well, okay, maybe that depiction wasn't entirely fair. Brief point on the class. When I said that, if anything, there's a class's argument is inverted today, there's a slight distinction. What I was saying was that, if anything, it's gotten to the point now where upper-class people are more supportive than lower class people. It's not a huge distinction, but it's just striking how much I suspect that has changed. And if you had done this poll with the income cohorts in the 1950s, I bet it would have been just down at the bottom for the really rich members of society.
You could argue that last time you had a swing back in opinion among college freshmen toward prohibition, it was because the wrong kind of people were doing it and we were worried about it. But now you've got people thinking the right kind of people are smoking marijuana, it's probably much harder to move than it was last time. Let's go to the audience.
I'm not sure that was true in the 80s, though. I think that those numbers really, that Carlin sent us, really raised some interesting questions, because I'm not sure it has to do, I think Sean makes an excellent point. I'm just not sure it explains those numbers.
Can I make one more point about class?
Please.
Which is, you have to be careful when it comes to race, because African Americans
yes.
have a very different experience. In the sense that you have the impact of the way it's enforced and also the, well, in my view, the kind of racial injustice around sentencing and enforcement.
Yes.
There's an ironic impact that I think African Americans tend to be a little more supportive or against legalization because they don't, because of the crime in their communities and because of what happens
yes.
to their young men. Now, you can see that once you talk about how you have a sort of a set of drug policies that are enforced differently and have a different consequence for African Americans, you actually have a very vocal, you know, from the grassroots set of African American activists on this issue, because they get sort of how that all works out. But I think it's a wrinkle on it that I think mm-hmm. is different, and it impacts the class argument.
And
I think
you could see more of this. A very smart opponent of legalization named Kevin Sabet is making the argument that, you know, it's very easy for wealthy white people in the upper middle class to talk about legalizing marijuana because they can handle it, but they're not going to be the people responsible for the places in society that cannot handle it. So I think we may see that argument fleshed out. Lex, we've got a lot of amazing people in the audience. What I'm going to do is ask for two or three at a time and kind of lump them so we can get to a lot of people as possible. I'm going to start way in the back, in the far back corner, gentleman with a red tie and a dark suit. Please, by the way, everyone, keep your questions short, because we've got a lot of folks here.
Thank you, John Magnuson with the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence. I'm curious, as we look at this as a political issue, I think that we have to deal with the facts of the issue as well. And I've heard several of the panelists talk about that marijuana isn't addictive. And the fact of that is that the number two in treatment centers across America, alcohol is the number one drug that's being treated, and the number two is marijuana. And so I'm curious why that continues to be bantered about, as that marijuana isn't addictive, because
Great.
It is.
Thank you. Let's take another one from the back, the gentleman on the same row in the white shirt.
Hi, my name is Oliver Grimm. I'm the U.S. correspondent for an Austrian newspaper called Die Presse.
Thank you.
Small question, are we only talking about marijuana, or did you also test opinions on hemp and cannabis? And if so, are attitudes of people different? Are these the same sort of people that have the same sorts of attitudes towards these two?
Hemp
similar.
Cannabis.
Hemp and cannabis, yeah. Sort of same but different,
sure.
different drugs. And the second question, if you think that the U.S. is going to continue with this state-by-state piecemeal approach towards legalization, what do you make of European experience particularly in the Netherlands, that is one of the very few European countries where it's legal under certain conditions, and who have actually introduced more severe regulations because they've seen a huge influx of people who only come to in the Netherlands to certain places like Maastricht simply to get high and to, you know, behave in not particularly pleasant ways. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Let's take one more from the back and we'll work our way to the front. How about the gentleman in the blue shirt here who's been...
Hi, Tom Donlan with Barron's, and I'd like to ask Anna in particular, but how it's possible to frame a persuasion for parents in particular, in the same way that other questions just raised about actual addiction. Clearly, I was a parent of young children in the 1980s, and it was clear that a lot of parents my age and younger were willing to support the Just Say No campaign that Sean experienced because they were afraid that something real bad would happen to their kids. How do you frame an argument? How do your proponents frame that argument to persuade parents?
Great set of questions. On the first one, we don't have addiction experts here. It's not that kind of panel. But there's an interesting question about why marijuana is perceived as basically fairly benign. Is that what all the polling shows at this point? It's perceived as a non-addictive substance?
Well, the main way that we tested it was relative to alcohol. And there is, I think, a perception that it is safer than alcohol, both that it's less addictive and also that you are not impaired in the same way when you're high from marijuana than you are when you're impaired by alcohol. You know, people will say in folks groups, no one dies from being too high, but you certainly can die from being too drunk, or nobody gets in their car and kills somebody. So there's that relative to alcohol. You know, I'm not a scientist, and I haven't done the research on addiction. My understanding from just having to write surveys on it is that it's no one's suggesting you can't abuse marijuana just like you can abuse anything. What they're suggesting is that it's not physically addictive the way nicotine and narcotics. That's my understanding of it. Maybe someone in the audience can be more clear about it, but I don't think that anybody, certainly in the legalization movement, is suggesting you can't abuse it, just like you can't abuse, you know, anything, including legal substances like alcohol. So,
yeah, a point you make that's very important. To me, it's the big takeaway of the paper is that no one out there or very few people are viewing marijuana as a positive good or a benign and good thing. They see prohibition as a lesser of evils. Is that a fair statement?
No, the greater of evils.
I'm sorry, legalization as the lesser of evils.
Well, I mean, first of all, just to be clear, at least in my own remarks, I was careful to report on public sentiment. I don't recall reporting my own on that or any other question. The question that I was reporting on was not the addiction question. It was marijuana as gateway to harder drugs question. And there the sentiments are pretty clear, but we make no representations about the relationship between public opinion on this question and underlying medical data. That would be well beyond my competence.
Yeah, and this is why results will matter.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Jonathan, but that was only a piece of the question you put to me.
Go ahead.
But I can't remember the other
piece. Oh, well, I'm there too. So we've got a lot on the table. So okay.
Could I just reiterate, I don't think we, not in this paper, not up here, make any claims about addiction one way or the other.
Yeah, we're not.
And the paper actually does not take any stand on the issue in question. We're trying to report data on what the public thinks and why the debate seems to have gone the way it has gone. And we don't have any data on the gentleman's question about fine distinctions among you know, hemp, and cannabis, and the like. I'm not sure the public makes that distinction, but Anna would know better than I.
Just to be clear, so similarly, I'm not talking from actual data that I've gathered. I'm suggesting what in focus groups we talk about whether or not it's addictive or what people, if they think it is, it's that kind of comparison to other kinds of drugs that people react to when they, and that's what I think drives the kind of comparison of marijuana to other things when I'm thinking about public opinion, but I'm not making a medical, you know, argument or a scientific argument. Can I talk about kids? That
Please.
Question? Okay. I think that actually this is it's a really important question, and it's one of the bigger vulnerabilities around legalization, which is what is the impact on kids? And there's the actual impact itself, though, as I said, parents, I think, are really realistic about their kids' access to drugs and alcohol and don't really think legalization is going to change it. In fact, it might make it harder for kids to get access. So there's some thought among parents, I think, that if you actually had a state-regulated system, you'd actually be able to protect your kids more. But the other piece, which is harder to answer, is that for parents or for people who think it is a gateway drug, then they think it is a signal that you're sending to kids that it's okay to do drugs, mm-hmm. right? And that could be, you know, anything, right? Any drug. So including drugs that people perceive are much more harmful, right, than marijuana. And what I think it's important for us to answer that question, and it's important, I think, and what you see, I think, from the legalization movement is a heavy emphasis on the kinds of penalties that are associated with selling to kids who are under the age of 21 or 18, depending on, but I think 21 is the consensus, just like alcohol. The kinds of, you know, regulations that have to be in place around the background checks for people who are selling. In other words, trying to create a system that actually is reassuring around what it can do to actually prevent younger people from smoking, because obviously the current system does not prevent younger people from smoking. So it's much more about kind of putting pieces in place and providing reassurance that it is not sort of a, you know, here's a, you know, sort of a, you know, you're sort of given free, it's not a free-for-all to just do drugs, but actually it's a way to try to regulate kids' access to
that's,
it.
That's an important point, and one I'm going to volunteer as an answer to the question from the Austrian gentleman about what do you do about, you know, what if Washington and Colorado become the pot suppliers for the entire country because you can't control the flow of marijuana outside their borders? That's the number one thing I believe the federal government will be looking at in evaluating the marijuana experiments in those states. I think number two will be access by children. And I think that's the number one thing the public will be looking at, too. It will be a disaster for proponents of legalization if they cannot control that. That's why in many cases it is legalization proponents who are advocating reforms like the ones of medical marijuana in California. They want to see a regulatory system in place so that they don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. But those are exactly the kinds of outcomes I think we'll be monitoring. Let's go to another round of questions. We've got plenty more. Let's be fair and start from the front this time. This gentleman here, then we'll
hold on, wait for the mic, please.
Yeah, there's a mic coming.
Rick Blake, Strategic Health Resources. We represent pharmaceutical firms and biotech firms that are interested in using cannabis as for therapeutic uses. I'm just going to say, first of all, there are over 900 strains of cannabis, and what are we talking about when we're talking about medical marijuana? We actually don't know because of the DEA's regulations in terms of the use of cannabis in clinical trials. So we actually don't know what we're doing. My question here.
That's reassuring.
No. I mean, in terms
certainly
of
the first in Washington.
But this is terms of medical uses, and there is a lot of anecdotal data for Kaposi syndrome in HIV patients in terms of the application of it. So I'm just saying, given that this is a public policy forum, do you see the shift in the landscape of a political opinion in terms of changing some of the impacts on how we conduct our clinical trials, the grows that we could use in terms of cannabis and clinical trials in this nation, because we're missing the boat, at least we think so, in terms of the therapeutic uses of cannabis.
Thank you. Lady on the aisle behind you had a question.
Hi, Alicia Caldwell with the Associated Press. Can you guys address the California model? They were the first to go with medical marijuana. They went full bore, if you will, into the mid-90s. There were, some describe it as more dispensaries than Starbucks, which is astounding for most of us. And now we're stepping back. The referendum last week to limit it to 135 dispensaries in Los Angeles. The Supreme Court of California ruled last month, I believe, or earlier this month, rather, that states or cities, rather, can limit and zone out dispensaries. They voted down Proposition 19 and now seem to be taking that step back as Washington and Colorado take the steps forward.
Great. Thank you. Let's get one on this side. Let's go to this gentleman up in the front with the yellow and brown tie, two rows up. We'll do the middle next, you guys.
Hi, I'm Andrew Stevenson. I'm with the Consortium of Social Science Associations. You mentioned the Just Say No campaign and Nancy Reagan. Do you think that society, we've reached a point where it's too late for another Nancy Reagan?
Great question.
Can we have another moral movement?
Great question. Impact on clinical trials. Has anyone tested opinion on research on marijuana?
I don't know.
I mean, the vast majority of people in this country and every state support medical marijuana, support people having access to it. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't surprise me if we tested whether or not we should be doing research on it in the federal government.
We're going to try.
I would assume the majority favor it, too. And I think, you know, the Obama administration said, they basically said at the beginning, we're not going to go after medical marijuana. Now, there was the Holder letter, which was a little less clear in California, right before the 19, but I think I'm not suggesting the Obama administration was going to let, you know, NIH do clinical trials, but they certainly were taking a step back on it relative to previous administrations. I don't know. I mean, I think that from a public opinion perspective, I have to believe the vast majority of people would support doing that research.
I was just going to say the same, that because, I mean, the difference between medical marijuana and views on just legalization for recreational purposes is so large that I suspect there would be support. Just on the could there be a step back, you know, alcohol is a subject on which opinion in America has really gone up and down and up and down over a very long period of time. And it would not surprise me if we had that pattern to some degree on marijuana, which is to say movement for prohibition sort of went way back in our history to the 1820s, 1830s. It was linked, as Sean suggested, at times to a movement against immigrants, you know, because the Irish were said to drink a lot, German immigrants were said to drink a lot, so there was a backlash. It actually divided the upper class in interesting ways. Then we passed it, and then it failed, and so we repealed prohibition. But then we've had a kind of return to a semi-prohibition when we raised the drinking age all over the country. And, you know, there is now a movement among some folks, particularly in college towns, to kind of push it back on the grounds that 18 to 21-year-olds are drinking anyway, and you're turning them into criminals. So it would not shock me if there is some ebb and flow on this again, even though we say in our paper,
yes,
we don't think it will ebb as much as it has in the recent past. But I suspect there could be ebb and flow. Bill?
Yeah, and I think that analysis helps to frame the history of the California model. And because, recall, what we found, number one, continuing ambivalence about marijuana. Very few people think that it's a positive good. People can see pluses and minuses. But second, this is driven by very practical considerations about enforcement, the costs of enforcement, and the unintended consequences of an enforcement regime. It does not surprise me at all to learn that there can also be unforeseen consequences of a pell-mell legalization right. regime that, for the same set of practical reasons, might incline people to draw back without doubling all the way back to the status yes. quo ante.
I would guess what you'll see in California is continued public movement toward favoring a general regime of legalization coupled with a regulatory movement
Absolutely.
To further restrict that. Both of those things can happen at once, and I suspect it will. We have a few more questions
but can
before
I just
we
make
get
a point about California.
Yes,
I think you should be careful to not view the failure of Prop 19 as to indicate something, some kind of attitudinal shift, because there were three issues with that proposition. One, there were opponents on the left and the right. There were folks who are part of the current, shall we say, production of marijuana in California that did not like that language. So that if you think about, we actually saw some defection from people who support legalization voting against 19. Second, it was not very well funded. And as you know, it's incredibly expensive to run an initiative campaign in California. And I do think running a funded professional campaign is a basically precondition for passing these initiatives, because you have to do a lot of education about what's wrong with prohibition. And third, 2010 could not have been a worse year for Democrats. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of the composition of the electorate. So I just want to be careful that we don't sort of look at 19 as somehow a reaction to dispensaries and sort of a movement away from support for legalization.
I'll be brief on the Nancy Reagan issue, because it actually ties back. We're trying to think of if there was a chance for prohibition to go backwards. And the one kind of instance I can think of us moving towards prohibition of a drug is tobacco. And I actually think that is tied up with class. You look at, you watch Mad Men, and you're like, well, of course they weren't going to make cigarettes illegal or restrict that everyone was smoking. Whereas my generation, I mean, very few of my friends grew up smoking because we grew up with public health campaigns that actually seemed validated by experience in life. We saw our grandparents and our great uncles die of lung cancer and emphysema. And we've reached a point where, you know, it's banned, and, you know, you have to go practically stand in the street to smoke a cigarette, and you can't smoke in restaurants, and that's tied up with class. And so if there were to be a major surge against marijuana prohibition, it would probably have to be, you know, we legalize it and we find out that it actually causes a heck of a lot of cancer. We find out that it is addictive. I use the word not addictive. I think it's habit forming, which is an important distinction, or can be habit forming. You know, something along those lines. We see a lot of a huge surge in people driving stoned and causing car wrecks. That, these externalities, you might see a pushback on the legalization movement.
Yeah, let's see if we can get in three or four more questions. We'll go to the middle this time. There's a gentleman in a yellow tie who's been patient. There's a gentleman over, way over there by the window under the TV who's been patient. And there was someone in front of you as well.
Thank you, Sean, for your comments. John Katz, Office of National Drug Control Policy. I was just going to talk about tobacco and relating our discussion to the public health issue. And my question is, with your research, are any of you familiar with asking the public, is legalization of marijuana a public health concern? And we've talked a lot about the other questions, but I'm curious if you've brought that up in any of your research.
I feel like asking you, so what's the administration going to do about Colorado and Washington State?
Unfortunately, I can't personally speak about that right now.
Really? Darn. What if we asked super nice? great. Can we? Was it, there were a few Did more in that vicinity. Any hands? No? All right, gentlemen in the blue shirt, gentlemen way in the back. I'm going to get you whether you want it or not.
Hi, I'm Brandon Levy from the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. I'm just wondering if there's any data, if this is strictly limited to marijuana, or if Americans' views of drug prohibition in general isn't working.
Great question.
If there's any, you know, if there are Americans that think we should move more to the European model, like Portugal did in 2001, in terms of decriminalization of all drugs.
Great question. Gentlemen back there, I'm coming to you because I always sit in the low visibility seat and hate never getting called. So I'm looking at a gentleman. Raise your hand again. No? Yeah, there you are. Thank you. Necktie, blue shirt.
Phineas Rueckert from the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. My question, you talked a little bit briefly about how there's lower support amongst Hispanic respondents in the polls you conducted. What possible explanations would you have for that?
Oh, excellent question. Has anyone polled on marijuana as a public health problem per se? When it's framed that way, what do you get?
I don't think so, or at least I haven't. But when we ask people in an open-ended context what their most significant concerns are, I don't really hear the public health concern. I hear the safety concern. Are people going to operate heavy equipment or have operation, you know, conduct perform operations or fly planes while they're high? Are kids going to get the wrong message? Those are the kinds of things that people mention, and I'm going to speculate that because people think that prohibition doesn't work and anyone who wants to smoke is smoking, it may be that they don't see the legalization of it as creating a new special public health concern, but if there is one, it's sort of there anyway because use is so, you know, widespread. But that's just speculation.
And that might be an issue that surfaces quickly if we run into problems with legalization. What about drugs generally? They move in a different path or a similar path to marijuana? Anybody?
I'm really mad I didn't look that up. But if I had to guess, I would guess it's different because most of us, there's actually a big cocaine scene in my law school, which was strange. But most of us don't have a lot of contact with cocaine going through college, certainly not with heroin. Those are still considered street drugs. And they, you know, if you do have experience with people who are on them, they kind of live up to their reputation as bad news. And so I would actually be surprised if there's been significant movement.
I looked at this for a paper I did for Brookings a few months ago, and what's interesting about marijuana is people are carving out a marijuana exception. Not much change on heavy, hard drugs. And part of what's happening is the perceived differentness of marijuana from other things. It's moving more toward the alcohol or maybe even tobacco category. The others are not. Hispanics, any idea?
Yeah. Have you... Do you want us to talk to Hispanics?
What I was going to say is ask Anna and if you had a thought, because I am very glad you asked that question, because it was something that jumped out at me as an excellent question, and I couldn't find in the data we had a good answer to that question.
Which
it made
question
me want to go out? Back to find some more data to try to figure that out. Anna, do you have
which question are we talking about?
On Hispanics.
Let you have answer first.
I guess I would query the premise of the question just a little bit, and I would direct you to, you know, the appendix chart 1 on page 12, where, you know, if you ask the question just flatly, do you think the use of marijuana should be made legal or not, whites, you know, non-Hispanic whites, 52-45, Hispanics, 51-47, no statistical difference. African Americans are a little bit more pro-legalization than whites or Hispanics, but there's not the Hispanic exception there. And then if you ask a key factual question, now let's look at chart number 2 on page 13, you know, does marijuana lead to the use of hard drugs? You know, here again, you have 38% of whites and 39% of Hispanics saying yes, 58% of whites and 59% of Hispanics saying no, no difference whatsoever. Once again, African Americans are a little bit different, but not startlingly so. As a matter of fact, I think probably, probably still inside the margin of error as I, you know, just...
No, but in fairness to the gentleman, yeah. He was responding to something I said, which is that among the religious groups, Hispanic Catholics were one of two groups to show a majority. You're quite right that perhaps the difference isn't as big, it just happens to be a majority, but they did jump out compared to the other religious groups. So I think that's where his question came from. You are correct to underscore that maybe the fact that it's a majority isn't that important because the other numbers are not all that different, but they did seem to stand out from the other groups. And I'm curious, that's why I wanted to turn to Anna.
I have not done specific research on Hispanics, but what we know on lots of social issues is that generation plays a huge role in attitudes around issues, whether it's, you know, gay marriage or abortion. I wouldn't be surprised if those generational differences exist among Hispanics. Yeah. But it's a different generational issue than the overall age issue, which is to say that the personal experience somebody has if they were not born here is the country they grew up in. I don't know enough about, you know, Mexico and, you know, El Salvador and all the countries of origin for, you know, immigrants here, Hispanic immigrants. But that's whatever that experience was probably influences their view about this as much as anything else. And for Hispanics who are born here, especially if they primarily speak English, you know, they look like everybody else on just about every single issue. There's no real difference. So some of those numbers on Hispanic Catholics may be driven by whether or not someone's first generation or was born in a different country.
One of my takeaways from this paper, and a reason I urge you all to read it and dive into the details, is the filters we're often used to using in Washington to evaluate issue polarities are partisanship, ideology, and ethnicity, and those turn out to be significantly less important on this issue, which is much more cross-cutting across personal experience and pragmatism. It's a different kind of issue. I urge you all to read the paper. It's a marvelous piece of work. We've only scratched the surface. I thank you all very much for coming. Again, I thank our partner Wola, Peter Singer, for helping fund this, and especially our panelists. I neglected to mention that Sean came all the way down from Columbus, Ohio, to be with us today. I'm sorry, not Peter Singer, Peter Lewis. I apologize. I'm a bit tired at the end of this session. Again, thank you all very much.